Hey, it's your host Omar, and welcome to the Curiosity Project. Today you are joining a conversation I had with Ricky Walters, founder of Salon 64. He is an entrepreneur and hairdresser to the celebrities. In this episode, we discuss Ricky's journey as a young man trying to find his calling, and how through persistence and drive, he carved a route for himself now running a revolutionary hair salon that attracts CEOs, sports people, and actors alike. He touches on the importance of doing what you love, the essential aspects of good work ethic, and the magic of sales. Thank you for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy the episode. Hi, Ricky, how are you?
I'm very well, how are you?
I'm very well, all good. How's your day been? What have you been up to? We're at the end of the week now. Talk to me.
Well, it's been busy. It's London Fashion Week this week, so we've been kind of doing a lot of hair ups, a lot of makeup, a lot of people going to shows. We're obviously in the middle of Soho, so people do just stop by. A lot of people leaving bags and belongings at the salon. Obviously, they have their hair done and stuff, but if you think you're going from show to show and you're really busy, I think that's a business in itself, you know? But it's been good. It's been buzzing and it's always fun. So yeah, it's been good. How's your day been?
Yeah, not bad. Not bad at all. I mean, we've had this heat wave in London. The weather has been absolutely insane. I mean, are you a hot weather person? Do you enjoy hot weather?
I enjoy hot weather. I have a kind of 14-month-old baby. I don't know those people that count in months with their babies. She's a year and in a few months, but I just thought I'll be one of those people.
And that you don't like it, but you're going to do it.
I don't like it, but I've become one of them.
Yes.
But yeah, I liked the hot weather until I had a child, and then actually it's a bit of an inconvenience. But I like tastefully hot. But I don't like, you know, lava.
Okay. I mean, it's kind of weird, though, because anything that's slightly above 22 degrees in London feels as though that it's about 58.
Yes.
This country is just not, this town, this city is just not, it's not built for this type of weather. It just feels so much hotter.
It does. Especially, I can tell you, in Soho, it's just not equipped for any heat whatsoever. It is close and all the buildings are close together and there's no windows anywhere. But yeah, otherwise I like it.
Good, 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 good. But no, the week has been good. How has London Fashion Week been for you? Have you had any notable people walk in or anything like that?
London Fashion Week has been good. Yeah, we've got a lot of people within the fashion industry kind of strolling in and out our doors. I did Vanessa White, who was she's a singer this morning. She used to be in the Saturdays and she's releasing some stuff. I had her in for a quick hair up this morning and then straight onto this kind of podcast. But yeah, I think London Fashion Week has been good. And I think it's nice to see that kind of, I think people really appreciate ever since kind of COVID and all those, you know, kind of more depressing times we've had. I think people still just really appreciate any sort of event where people can kind of get out and celebrate. And that's, I guess, what London Fashion Week really is. So yeah, it's been a good one. Not too crazy, not too quiet. Nice so far, but anything can happen.
Is fashion, aside from, because we'll kind of get onto your story and the world of kind of, you know, hairdressing and barbering and all this other sort of stuff, but and also your entrepreneurship story, because that in itself for me is kind of absolutely fascinating. When we were together, it would have been a couple of months ago now, right? You know, your story was so fascinating and so interesting, and at your age, it's really, really extraordinary. So well done. I mean, I'll say well done before you even told the story. And for me, it just makes my heart very happy to see, you know, fellow young people, you know, taking what it is that they want from life, if that makes sense. We had an interesting conversation about manifestation and how manifestation has kind of been bastardized by the new generation. It's the manifestation has gone from the idea of having goals with commitment and consistency to now it's been, if you sit there with your legs crossed and, you know, chant a couple of times, then the universe will give you what it is that you deserve. And that just breeds this entire generation of entitlement, So, you know, it was very interesting to kind of have that conversation with you. But just talking about London Fashion Week for a moment, is fashion something that's quite important to you personally? Is it something that you dial into on a daily basis, or are you just the kind of guy that just throws whatever on?
I am certainly not the Gokwan of the salon. I am not a fashionista. I don't really know the first things about it from a personal perspective. However, hair trends, makeup trends, everything is revolving around fashion. So if something, you know, if there's a 90s revival in terms of the clothes people are wearing, it won't take long for hair to follow suit. The same as if, you know, I don't know, 80s, 70s, any era, once that comes back into fashion, it doesn't take people long to then go, oh, my hair needs to match this kind of vibe. So we have to be a little bit clued up at what's going on. We have to be a bit clued up at what's going on the catwalk. We have to be clued up at what celebs are wearing, what their kind of vibe is. And then it does just filter down to the likes of you and me that kind of then go shopping and say, oh, I quite like the look of that shirt, or I'm going to wear a bit of linen. Unfortunately, I think what you discover, if you really think about it, is it's all predetermined for us. We all think we're being original and kind of going shopping and picking something. But I think there's been huge boardroom meetings about what these kind of designers and shops and retailers are going to release. And then we go in and select one of those items. So I'm not huge on in terms of kind of what I'm wearing. I really like to be comfortable. I have to move around a lot for my job. I have to wear a lot of different hats. I have to be, you know, in a business meeting in, you know, in the city one day or in the morning, for example, but then be client facing in the evening. And I also just kind of like to be me, and that's kind of what I wear, and, you know, get on with it. So we have to be aware of it. But yeah, by no means am I some sort of Soho fashionista. I'd like to be.
Sure. Well, it kind of reminds me of that scene, right, in The Devil Wears Prada, with mm-hmm. Anne Hathaway's character is talking about how she thinks that fashion is this kind of insane world. And I think it was, God, what was her name? Miranda something. The lady who's meant to be Anna Wintour. She kind of goes into this long story about how the color of her jumper, cerulean, is a choice that was made by a larger fashion group, and it was you know, she is vicariously involved within her choices are vicariously involved within the world of fashion. So it's quite interesting, actually, when you kind of look at it like that. Now, if you don't mind, Ricky, I'd love for you to kind of rewind the clock a little bit, and just, you know, tell me a little bit about, first and foremost, how did you kind of get into this world? Why did you get into this world? What was your stimuli in the beginning? Where did you see your life going before you started in the world of hairdressing? What were you doing? What was going on?
So I've only ever done hairdressing. I've never done any other job.
Why just hairdressing?
Well, I left school at, say, 15, 16 years old, with no qualifications to my name, no GCSEs, nothing really that would kind of academic probably help me get a job. I had a really good time at school. I loved it. I loved education. But I was probably having too much of a good time and not enough actually work orientated. So I left school at 15, 16 and needed to get a job because, I you know, it was my parents very quickly told me that money does not grow on trees, which I was really disappointed by. And right. I've always kind of secretly loved the idea of kind of getting a job and earning money, even from a really young age. That's what's motivated me. So I still had no ambition to join the hair industry or anything like that. I would have done anything that just paid a bit of money. So I walked the high street. I handed my CV, which was pretty blank, to be honest with you, into every shop on the high street, an optician's, a jeweler's, a supermarket. And there happened to be a very small hair salon, 4 or 5 chairs in the high street that said help wanted. Popped my CV in and managed to get the job. And it was there where I was kind of sweeping floors and cleaning bowls and making coffee that I thought, I kind of like this hairdressing stuff, you know. It was kind of just fluke, really. I would have done anything, but I really like it. So I spent a month there, decided actually if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it properly and go to the biggest, baddest name in London. At the time, that was John Frieda in Mayfair. I managed to pass an interview at 16, joined John Frieda's salon as an apprentice. and worked my way up, really. So I spent the kind of next 5 years there, kind of learning how to be a Mayfair hairdresser at the time. It was very old school, kind of old money Mayfair, ladies coming in for their blow dries. But I learned a lot. I learned a lot about the industry and how it all worked. And then I decided to move from there and kind of rebrand myself. John Frieda, there was a load of apprentices, all young, hungry apprentices, all wanting to be hairdressers on the shop floor. And there just wasn't going to be space for me. I think I've got the record, even till this day, for taking my final tests the most amount of times just to get on. I would just take it every week until they passed me. But it came clear that actually there wasn't really much incentive to put me on the shop floor. They needed the apprentices. There wasn't any space, right. And I probably have to wait around. So I handed out my CV to all the competitors, all the other big London salons, and said, look, I'm an assistant now. I don't have a client base, but I am an investment. And if you buy into me now, I will generate you kind of a return on investment longer term. I was probably about 21 when that was the time. And then, I got kind of took on from Daniel Galvin. I went over to them in the Corinthia Hotel. And the Corinthia Hotel had just opened. It was a brand new 5-star hotel. And I just fell in love with it. I was like, this is amazing. You know, I saw the penthouse. I saw the spa. I couldn't believe it. So, and that's where I kind of made my name for myself, really. And I spent 5 years there. I eventually became the manager. I wrote a business plan and put it on the hotel manager's desk with a little post-it note saying that I'll turn your salon around. The salon at the time was quite quiet. It wasn't the Corinthia's main priority. They, you know, they wanted to be selling these big penthouses. So I managed to become the manager. I turned it from a loss-making business to a profit-making business. And then I spent 5 years enjoying it. I loved it there. It's a great place. And then at the age of 26, I decided if I can kind of turn this little salon with no foot flow in the middle of a 5-star hotel into a successful business, perhaps I could do that for myself. I wrote another business plan, and this one was designed for my clientele. I have an incredible client base at the time, and still do. And two of my clients said they'd invest in the idea of Salon 64, and I opened the doors of Salon 64 when I was 26, and now I'm 32. And here we are doing a podcast.
Yeah, that's a fucking crazy story. I mean, that's very, very, it's very cool. It's very cool. I think, you know, look, that sounds like a fairly, it sounds like a journey that makes perfect sense, right? Mm. The industry, and I think this is what's really cool, right? Is the industry chose you. You didn't really choose the industry. Mm. And I think that's really kind of symbolic and kind of interesting. But your journey sounds kind of, you know, like it just makes perfect sense. The flow is all there. But when you mention the ages to me, 21, 26, 32, like this is absolutely extraordinary. And I wonder when you turn back that clock, and I'm guessing so many people come in and out your doors and they ask you, oh, how did you get into it? It's such a standard question, right?
Yeah.
So you probably tell this story many times a day. But I wonder, are you someone that dials into that feeling of pride? Do you look back and think, wow, you know what, Ricky, you've done a pretty good job, mate. You know, is that someone that you are? You or are you the person to say, well, that's done and dusted. That was yesterday. What are we doing tomorrow? You know, what goes through your head when you think about these achievements?
So I believe some people are perhaps got an addictive personality, and some people have
addictive or obsessive. Addictive or obsessive, which one are we talking about?
I think addictive. I think they're addicted to things, and some people have alcoholism and they're addicted to alcohol and they can get help, and people say, oh, I think you've had enough, or we're worried about Ricky, he's drinking too much. Some people are addicted, you know, suffer with addiction with drugs, and people around them will try and stop them. And then you've got other people that are addicted to work and addicted to just pushing forward constantly. And I think that's the bracket I fall into. I am absolutely 100% addicted. I don't know anyone that really looks back and goes, wow, that was good. You just keep wanting more and more and more. You know, first it was a hair salon, which it still is today. Then we opened Club 64, which is the private members club element of the business, which has an event side. Then we've got products. You know, it's just constantly chasing something. And when you're addicted to growing a brand or anything like that, people around you don't stop you. They actually encourage you. They say, God, you know, Salon 64 is doing so well. What about this? I love this. So it is pure adrenaline, foot on the gas, 100 miles an hour all the time. But at the same time, I really enjoy it. And I'm not really getting any kind of negative feelings from it at the moment. So, yeah, I don't look back. It is constantly what's next, what's next. Grow the brand, grow the brand.
Okay, and when you were 21 years old, when you were kind of trying to build your name from an apprentice and, you know, trying to build your own client base, and you were at the Corinthia, you were at John Frieda, you're kind of within the Mayfair scene at the time, you know. For two questions. Number one, did you experience any levels of ageism, right? So the idea to say, well, this is just a kid, what the fuck does he know? If you did, how did you deal with that? And also, kind of, how did you communicate your vision to people who were the decision makers? What were the keys to help you to grow from such a young age? Because I think the one thing that I talk to, because I mentor a couple of younger guys who are 19, 20, 21. And the one thing that I'm constantly talking to them about is the idea of communicating your vision in an honest and upfront way and just accepting what it is that you don't know, because you don't know a lot, and you have to lean on people around you who know a lot more than you do. And the idea of being open to what you don't know is actually a very refreshing thing for a young person, because you can learn a lot more very quickly. But what was your thing? What do you feel as though was your key that you could communicate to people who are younger than yourself, who are in your position?
So I think anyone in that situation definitely has kind of come across ageism of some sort, because when you are 16, 21 or 26, which were kind of my milestones, people do look at you as a baby, especially when you're pitching to a 50, 60 year old, you know, that you know, they've probably got kids that are older than you.
Yeah.
But that said, I kind of always tried to twist it into a bit of a perk, into a positive, not a negative. For example, people would say, oh, you seem to have done a lot for someone your age at only 26, almost, you know, trying to poke or gauge if it's true or how legitimate it is, or even how well you can possibly do that just because of a number that you can't help. You can't help your age. I used to say to these people all the time in interviews that imagine doing my job at 26 years old instead of 46. So I was managing a salon inside a 5-star hotel. I said, you have to work a lot harder. You have to work a lot quicker. You have to do a lot more things to gain respect and for people to take you seriously. So why would you take a punt on someone that's done it the normal amount of time at 40, which already demands and commands a room at that age? I'd say it's much more impressive for a 26-year-old to walk in and say, I do the same thing and I've done it quicker than him, so I'm probably going to go further. And I think you have to overcompensate with confidence when you are younger, because if they do smell a hint of doubt, I think your age will almost, publicize that to the person opposite you far more. So you have to have that level of self-belief and confidence, whether deep down you believe it or not. I think it's that phrase, fake it till you make it. I definitely lived off that for the first majority of my career. It's only really recently that I felt very comfortable that, I guess that is when you can look back and go, well, actually, I've lasted 6 years and one pandemic here. I think I'm all right at this, you know? So I guess it is confidence and almost bravado and a bit of fake confidence. But I'm constantly assessing. I think business is mainly made up of psychology. So what you heard, my story was what I call the Hollywood version. Things didn't happen that quickly. It took me a year to find a landlord that would rent his premises to me. Now, after COVID, there's tons of empty shops. At the time, there were no empty shops, and I was being bullied out of the way by the likes of Pret a Manger or Starbucks or someone that says, look, we've got, we can give you 10 years rent up front, we'll have that space in Soho. So I would have to go into big landlord property meetings as a 26-year-old and convince these guys, don't rent to them, which is clearly not a risk. Rent to me, who's got no track record, no qualifications, and no business behind him. Yeah. And you constantly, I think, as long as a young person is constantly going into these meetings and learning and saying what went well and repeat it, and what didn't go well and don't repeat it, and learn from it and change from it, that's the best thing I did. I think it's someone that goes in with inexperience and just repeats the same things that aren't working. Yeah. I believe practice makes permanent. If you're constantly practicing the same wrong techniques all the time, you're not actually moving forward or growing. And even till today, I still am always assessing what worked, what didn't work, change the things that didn't work, and continue to grow the ones that did.
Yeah, incremental changes are so important. I mean, there's a great old phrase. It's essentially what you just said. You know, the sign of a fool is a man who decides to do the same thing but expecting different results. You know, and it's so true. And we see so many people like that who, you know, are just constantly banging their head against the wall and trying the same thing over and over again, and not understanding that it's not the circumstances, it's the implementation. Mm-hmm. You know, the circumstances will remain the same, but it's your implementation of action that needs to change. So I totally agree with that. You have to remain dynamic. You have to remain agile. You have to constantly assess situations and kind of pivot very, very quickly. And I think that makes the difference between a successful entrepreneur and a very successful entrepreneur. I think that's you can be successful by remaining fairly stagnant. And I know many people who are fairly successful in running their own businesses. Maybe they haven't scaled their businesses up or whatever, but that's fine. If that works for them, then that works for them. But if you're someone who is addicted to the idea, actually, let me ask you something, Ricky, are you addicted to business, or are you addicted to the industry that you're in? What are you addicted to?
Business.
Really? Okay.
Do you get any business, a fruit stall, anything? I walk down the high street, I look at that and go, God, why do they brand it like that? Why don't they do this? God, that thing hanging the window's wonky. They should be doing this. There's just everything. I'm actually really annoying to walk down the road with. Everything is constantly, gosh, you know, how do we do that? I just love the whole ethos and psychology and food chain and every environment of all businesses aren't that different. I sell haircuts and colors and hair services, but you know, a mechanic fixes cars, and you know, an optician sells glasses or whatever. You know, it's all pretty much the same fundamentals.
Yeah. You're totally right. I mean, it's all sales at the end of the day, isn't it? You're selling a product, you're selling a service, you're kind of marketing yourself in a certain way. And it seems as though that your superpower from a very young age has been your ability to be able to market yourself as a trustworthy and reliable bet, right? As someone who is a good prospect. And I think that's something that I can definitely relate to, and I can definitely understand. It's not so much because I wonder for someone, because this idea of confidence, it's something that, like, it's something I've only truly understood since, because I'm only 27, but it's something that I've only really understood in the last 3 or 4 years, I would say. And I wonder if you were to help someone to create a shortcut to getting to that optimum version of themselves. When you're pitching for business, you want to exude a certain energy. You want people to see you as trustworthy, to someone who has a great work ethic, but you don't want to come across as someone who is shining very bright for a very short period of time. You know, you want to show longevity, which is difficult for someone young, and some people might consider that to be cocky or arrogant. And I wonder what did you do to keep yourself on kilter as opposed to tripping over into that world of being a bit of an asshole?
Yeah, hopefully I dodged it. I think you've got to work backwards. So it's not about how I want to feel. It's about how I want the person opposite to perceive me. So when you go, my favorite food is chocolate cake. Love chocolate cake, it's great. But when I go fishing, I'm not gonna catch any fish with chocolate cake. I need worms. I don't like to eat worms, the fish like to eat worms. So we need to, the mindset has to shift to not what I want to be or how I personally want to be branded or perceived, but how does the person opposite want to see me? What are the goals? What is the vision? And what steps do I need to take that? So it's very easy to mentor someone and go, oh, here's the problem. You're not confident enough. I've got an idea. Be confident. How do you be confident? So what we do is I would look at, who are you meeting that you want to be confident? Why do you want to be confident? What's the reason for that? And then what is the perception of confidence? So if you asked an individual to write down what a confident person looks like, what would they write down? Body language, tone of voice, the way they walk, talk, eat, whatever, right? All these things make confidence, in my opinion. The way they smile, the way they
can quiet. It's the whole package. It's the whole package. Exactly.
And then I'd go and I'd break that down further, you know, and how do we achieve that? How do we walk? How do we talk? How do we smile? So I have a team of, you know, my apprentices here often leave school with no qualifications. They start at the age of about 16 years old, some of them. And wow. We will literally teach them to walk, talk and shake hands, because you don't learn that at school. I was never taught it at school. I had to learn the hard way, trying to, you know, hustle my way through to a business plan and getting jobs I wanted. And I learned on the way. But I do think there's a gap where people need to be taught these things. I think it's not good enough to just say you need confidence, but actually break down what confidence is and how you deliver on that.
Interesting. And now I'm gonna ask you maybe a bit of an unusual question. So I don't think people give barbers or hairdressers enough credit in terms of their ability to be personable. Mm-hmm. I know particularly within kind of guy circles, the barber is referred to as their therapist, right? It's the guy that you can talk to about anything and everything. You receive no judgment. You receive genuine advice. And it's more than just a haircut for some people. It's more than just a styling process for some people. I think the question that I would ask is, when somebody sits down in your chair, you've never seen them before. You might not even know who they are. I know you told a very funny story on a new show about how Djokovic sat in your chair. You didn't know who he was. You know, you don't know who they are. Explain to me what's going through your head. How do you go from not knowing someone, and how long does it take you to finish an appointment? Let's say 45 minutes.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah.
So how do you go from 0 minutes to 45 minutes and making that person essentially your best friend? What goes through your head? What's going through what's happening up there?
Yeah. So I feel like this is something that I'm quite good at. So my first rule is people do business with people they like. That is rule 101. If they don't like you, no one wants to spend time with you, no one's gonna do business with you, no one's gonna do anything with you, you know? So just don't, like you said, don't be an arsehole, be a nice person, you know. I think people have walked from appointment to appointment with, we're all playing a character. I'm playing the character of the hairdresser. The guy serving the coffee is playing the character of the barista. We're all playing characters. So when that person's walked into prep or walked to get their breakfast or their porridge or whatever they've done before coming to the salon, they're met with a character that could be quite unhappy in their job role, that might not really care when they serve you that cup of coffee and just go, oh, that's, you know, $3.99 or whatever. They don't care. And that happens all the time to me. You know, you go to even the supermarket, whatever, there's not really that level of care. And I actually think customer service is on the decline. I think it's a dying art form.
100%, particularly in London.
Yes,
like customer service in London is dog shit. It is dying. It is ridiculous. I literally leave every high-end encounter that I have, whether it be a luxury store or whatever, I leave feeling robbed every single time. It is the worst. So yes, I just want to support that statement.
Yeah, and prices are going up, but customer service is going down. So I'm on a mission to change that. And essentially, it's, you know, giving a warm welcome, a first impression, a shake of the hand or whatever it is, or, you know, even a hug. I think, you know, you instantly friend zone someone, and that's my mission, is to friend zone people. And it's real. It's not an act. Like, you know, I become my clients' mates very quickly, and I like them. I think they're nice people. You know, and we talk about them. It's not about me and all that, you know, I'm not there to kind of be ego tickled. I want to hear all about them. They say, for example, I was reading a book and it quotes that the best salesperson is actually a dog, because we're all a dog is always happy to see you without, no matter what you've done wrong, a hard day, whatever. People come home and the dog's staring at them and their little face, and they just want to know all about you. And I think, at the moment with social media and everything, it's all about me, the individual, and what I do is try and shift that, reflect it, and make it all about the person in my chair. What's their story? How did they get here today? Where have they come from? What do they do for a living? That's probably my favorite bit of hairdressing, is I find people fascinating. Absolutely fat. Everyone's got a story. Everyone's got a story.
Okay, so
And
how do you start to break down those kind of barriers? Because I'm guessing like a lot of the people, so the reason why I mentioned this, so like a lot of the people that are sitting down in your chair, these people are not your kind of, Joe Bloggs or anything like that. These are some significant individuals. And we can obviously go into some of those stories a little bit later, but let's just kind of keep that as the mystery, celebrity or whatever it might be. These are people who go around with these barriers up, right? How do you start breaking those down? Because I'm sure they see lots of happy faces. I'm sure they see, everyone who sees them, oh, so good to see you, Mr., Orlando Bloom or whatever it might be, so good to see you, Andrew Garfield. So, it's like everyone is like that. But how do you start to break down those barriers? How do you, how, what are the, are there any kind of mechanisms that you're using during, because it's not long. And I have to say, the experience that I had with you, Ricky, and the reason why I'm pushing this point a little bit a little harder is because the experience that I had with you was absolutely extraordinary. You were very good, and it came second nature to you in just developing a very intimate rapport very quickly with the person sitting in your chair. It was very impressive to kind of see that. So I just want to really understand the psychology of what's going on there.
I guess read a room is probably the main bit, isn't it? Like, if someone's coming in and they, not making eye contact, they're very one word answers, very closed answers, and you've tried opening them up and they keep putting that wall there, I'm only going to irritate them by probing further. I had a client the other day. I went to her hotel room. She literally said, as I walked in, "I hope you don't mind, I've got a ton of work to do on my laptop." She told me how to do her hair, and that was it. And it was the first time I've met her. And so if I started to try all these little kind of techniques to build a rapport with her, ask her about where she, what she does for a living, blah blah blah, it's because she won't ever book me again. She doesn't want that from me. So you, it's I'm the hairdresser is designed to be whatever the client wants us to be. Some people
Sure.
are quite chatty. Some people want a therapist. Some people actually just want to close their eyes and relax and switch off. So you have to be a chameleon and read the room of that individual, and constantly assessing that individual from the minute they walk in. What could their story be? Look how they're dressed. Look how they walk. Look how they talk. The language they're using. There's cues constantly to pick up on in people's language. And to just be, an active listener, I suppose. And before you know it, if they want to open up to you with a few questions from the hairdresser, they'll start to open up. And, not, going anywhere nice on your holidays. We ask proper questions and have a proper insight and interest into their answers, where we delve deeper. And then when people open up to you, they trust you and they become your mate, and they are my mates.
Interesting, interesting. And I think kind of going a little bit further into this concept that you have, because it is a very interesting concept. And I really commend you as well for at the age of 26 deciding that there was an underserved, there was a section within the industry that was underserved. And I think it's very difficult for young people to believe in their visions, right? I think people always think, oh, well, maybe it won't work out, maybe it won't do this, maybe it won't do that. I think, it helps, I think, most people, most successful entrepreneurs in my experience, and also in a lot of the books that I read, tend to be natural optimists, right? They very much seem to be the people who see the glass as half full as opposed to half empty. I know that that's what I'm like naturally. You seem, I mean, if I was to just take a guess, Ricky, I mean, you seem like someone who is extremely extroverted. You love being around, interesting people and engaging and talking, and you seem to be someone with lots and lots of energy, someone who is a natural optimist, who's very much like, well, let's not talk about the problem, let's talk about the solution, which is, again, very much how I kind of align myself in my problem solving. And I, you know, I wonder what is the concept of Salon 64, and how has that kind of evolved with time? What was so different about it when you started it?
So yeah, I'm a definite optimist. I'm annoyingly optimistic. In an emergency, it just doesn't sink in really. I'm already kind of like, right, what's the good bits of this? Most of my life I was very shy. It takes me a while to kind of become confident. I started off, I was a very, very shy child. And then as I kind of progressed through high school, my confidence picked up. But then I reverted back into that shy child again when I was kind of early apprentice. I wouldn't talk to anyone. I wouldn't sit in the staff room at John Frieda. I'd go outside, even in the depths of the winter, and just eat my lunch somewhere quiet. I'm very shy naturally. Wow. It's taken me a while to kind of come out of my shell and feel confident. But yeah, Salon 64 wanted to fill a gap in the marketplace, really, where if you asked 100 people on the street to draw a hair salon, they would draw the same thing. Mirror, chair, all facing outside on the perimeters of the room. And we wanted to break that down. When I was at the Corinthia, I was having a great time with my clients. I was building up a clientele, and people would say things like, you know, even things like, can I charge my phone? Which at the time, you know, 10 years ago, it was a bit annoying. I had to unplug things, and, you know, phone chargers weren't as accessible, especially in a 300 room hotel. People would want to bring their friends and just sit with them, and it was kind of taking up a salon seat. People would say, can I stay and do my makeup? And what I discovered was there was a gap in the market for all these things. We were ordering drinks from the restaurants and from the lobby and getting them brought up to the salon. And I wanted to create this like hangout where people could just, you know, order drinks, do their makeup, charge their phones, get themselves ready, almost like the ultimate pre-drinks for the night out. And that was when we kind of created Salon 64, and we decided, actually, why do all the seats have to face the wall? They should all face inwards. And we created a fire pit where it's, you know, all the mirrors kind of pop up, and we can have it look as much or as little like a salon as we like. And that kind of worked really for the first kind of bit of business, until we wanted to again push it further. And we created Club 64, which is the speakeasy after-hours private members club when all the hairdressers go home. So we have a full bar license in the salon. It has a full cocktail bar. So then we got Club 64 going. And then, again, not staying still, constantly pushing the brand, making it bigger. That was when we created the retail range, which is our shampoos and conditioners.
Nice. And I wonder, Ricky, in terms of, you mentioned the challenge in terms of securing your premises, right, and competing with some of these larger corporations and conglomerates. Aside from that, which I think is just a problem, generally speaking, in central London, you're competing against, you know, there's only a handful of people in central London that own all the property anyway. So, you know, you're constantly competing against only a handful of landlords. You're competing against, you know, your high street brands, which is where the landlords want security at the end of the day. So aside from that, because that's something that everyone experiences, what were some of the challenges that you experienced and are experiencing? And how do you feel as though that the way of which that you've dealt with it has affected your leadership style, generally speaking, moving forward? What are some of the biggest learning experiences that you've experienced since you opened Salon 64?
Well, I think that's something that never gets spoken about enough, really, because people hear like what I would call like my star story, and it's like, you know, 26-year-old, wrote a business plan, got investment, came from, you know, like no qualifications, whatever. And actually, there's like, that's the, like I said, it's the Hollywood version, but everything was a struggle, to be honest with you. Not just securing premises, but even once you're open, right at the beginning, there's a team of about 25 of us now. I started with me and about 3 or 4 others. I've grown that over the years. And there was times at the beginning when I remember going outside on my mobile phone and ringing the salon number because I thought the phone was broken because it wasn't.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, wow.
And it wasn't broken. It just weren't ringing. So you have to think creatively. We also, your strengths that you on paper think are going to be your strengths, like the fact that we don't look anything like a salon. We look like a cool bar or restaurant or hotel. I thought would be only a huge strength. But if you're not busy, you don't have anyone doing hair inside, it's empty, right? people walking past think you're a cocktail bar or think you're a restaurant or a hotel. And honestly, people would walk in off the street saying, oh, hi, can I just get a table for two? Or can I order some sushi? Do you guys serve sushi? And you're thinking, oh, no, no wonder people don't make salons not looking like salons, because no one knows it's a bloody salon. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm convinced for the first year, people were running around Soho looking for a place to get their hair done, would look over at Salon 64 going, oh, that's a salon, it's a bar, and carry on walking. So things that you presume were going to be your strengths or a big selling point can be a negative. But you have to kind of, again, think creatively. You know, the problem isn't my salon. The problem is, we've got an amazing salon. The problem is the public aren't educated to understand what the brand is because they've never seen such a thing, right? So then you have to kind of create more questions. Well, the question isn't, you know, how do we redesign the salon to be like everyone else's? The question became, how do we educate the public? And that was purely, I had to show them, and I needed a platform to show them what the salon was about. I needed to get them inside my building. We opened in October 2017. It was cold, it was dark. We looked like a restaurant and no one was inside and my phone weren't ringing. So I knew I had to somehow conduct tours to the public rushing past in the winter. So me and the team and my receptionist at the time used to stand out there with little paper cups, like takeaway coffee cups of hot chocolate, because it's cold and we thought, well, that'll get people to stop. And we knew we had really nice hot chocolate. And it was for them to kind of grab that off of the tray and taste. And then the idea is we could educate them. Again, there was more problems. And the problem this time was that people are greedy and just want the hot chocolate. They'd run over, they'd take a shot and they'd run away. And we couldn't even tell them anything about, like, oh, we're a salon, this is what, they didn't care. They were just like, give me the hot chocolate, I'm late. So we replaced the paper shot glass, the paper espresso cups with glass shot glasses.
So they have to stay there.
Well, the British public are far too polite to steal a glass shot glass. So what the trick was, I taught everyone, when they pick up that little shot, you take the train, you walk inside, and they would follow you in through the door. And like, we used to have races around the salon where people would chase us trying to put their shot glass back on the tray, but they'd have to listen to everything we said. And there was just little things like this where actually, if you think about it, it's just psychology, isn't it? No one's going to nick a glass from you. They're going to follow you to put it back on that tray. So if you walk around your salon giving them a tour, I would take them. I wouldn't let them put the glass on my tray. I'd put the tray down by my side, and I would walk all through the salon, downstairs, upstairs, everywhere. They got a full tour, business card, and then they put the glass down on the bar and off they went. So little stuff like that, really, which really, what I'm trying to say is the problem isn't actually the problem you think it is. You know, the problem is something completely different. And for me, it was educating the public of Soho and trying to find a strategy that worked. But to be honest with you, what were the difficulties? Everything. Everything was a difficulty because that's what business is like.
Yeah. And how did you go from educating the public of Soho? Because I think this is where this is where my brain starts to kind of kick in. Because I think I spoke to you about this anyway. Like my thing is all about scaling business, right? It's about how do you serve 5 people? Okay, that's great. How do you serve 50 people? Okay, lovely. How do you serve 5,000 people? How do you serve 50,000? How do you serve 500,000? You know, like that's where I'm very. That's I think I told you about this anyway. That's essentially what I do, right? And I wonder, how did you go from serving and educating? Because this is a conversation I had with a friend of mine. He runs an amazing coffee company. Actually, this is someone I need to introduce you to. Just an unbelievable individual, one of my closest friends. We were talking about the idea of educating the public, right? And unfortunately, the it's a nomenclature, it's a misnomer to assume that the public wants to be educated, because actually most people don't. They're very happy with the way that they're living. You know, people find a great deal of solace and peace in regularity, right? You call someone up, let's say that you're a waste disposal company. You call up someone, hey, I've just started a waste. No, we're happy with who we're using. End of story, you know? Even if there's a better deal on the table, most people won't actually take the better deal. They will just stick with what they know. You know, what's the phrase that the devil it's the devil you know is better than the devil you don't, right? So they're both going to fuck you at the end of the day, but it's just about exactly what you're familiar with. So it's about understanding, do they want to be educated or do they want to be proposed to? Are you going to proposition someone? And Americans love to be proposed to. They love propositions. They love to be sold to. It's part of their culture. You know, they love the idea of being sold to. Well, what do you want from me? What am I going to get from this exchange? And how is this transaction going to benefit me?
Yes.
The English, on the other hand, they don't seem to enjoy that process very much. They like to kind of dance around it a little bit and, you know, talk about family and talk about this and talk about that. And then business is kind of an afterthought, right? So I wonder, how did you go from educating the public of Soho to then having the glitz and glam of Hollywood walk through your doors? How, what was that process? What were the struggles of that process and how did you overcome those?
So absolutely correct. If you look like a salesman, if you talk like a salesman, act like a salesman, you know, hello, I'm calling from the waste disposal company, already it's too late, because they don't, British public don't want to see a salesman. They can see you a mile off, you know, whatever you're, if you're dressed in a suit with a name tag, you're like, you know, the ones when you're walking down the high street, they go, can I stop you for 2 seconds?
You're so like, yeah, that, no, thanks.
Yeah, no, sorry, busy, late, whatever, you know. So I think it's the way that you, you know, I wasn't selling. I was out there in the cold nights of winter giving them hot chocolate to warm them up and then walking away with the tray. You know, and then we were friends and we were having a chat. That's different, right? Whereas if I stood there giving out flyers, that's not going to benefit them, is it? Hot chocolate benefits them. So that was one way of doing it. But as you say, how did I go from doing that with a handful of people in Soho to then scaling my business? You start educating different people. So I learned in my business, I was educating, you know, 1 in 20 people walking past might book a haircut. It probably wasn't even that. It was probably 1 in 200. But yeah. I needed to educate hairdressers the same way, because hairdressers had clients and they could then work at Salon 64 and help me. So I carried on educating the public, but my audience changed from being direct to clients to having busy hairdressers I was educating instead.
Interesting, and I'm guessing that you were relying on that level of delegation to kind of say, well, listen, look, this is my information, this is my knowledge. I can't have 4 or 5 rookies running around, but what I can have is I can pass over my knowledge, effectively use delegation, and rely on you guys to spread the message. Essentially, is that the method that you used?
Pretty much, you know, they might, you know, be looking for a new salon to join. Maybe they're unhappy in their current salon. They want to join a new salon. With that might come a clientele, or might come even one client. That's another client we've got of Salon 64. So we changed, we didn't change our audience, but in addition to the audience that we were trying to educate, we also educated within the industry. And that as well kind of helped. That was probably more for scale.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I have to say, Ricky, you know, what a genuinely extraordinary story. You know, it's you know, just massive congratulations. I think for kind of, I asked you a question when I had my my appointment with you, and I said, was there a moment where you sat there and thought, you know, what the fuck am I doing? You know, did you ever think what is my future going to look like? And you kind of laughed and you looked at me and you said, I always knew that I was going to end up like this. You know, I didn't know it, but I knew it, you know. And I love the fact that you had so much confidence in yourself. You know, it's something that needs to be kind of passed over. It's something that needs to be communicated, that if you believe in yourself, no one will believe in you the way that you can believe in yourself at the end of the day. You will come across people who will help you, but you have to do it yourself.
And we spoke about like young people like waiting or not feeling confident, but isn't it the best time to do it when you're like 26 or 16? Like, what you got to lose? Do you know what I mean? Like, if it doesn't work out and you do it for 10 years, you're coming out of it still really young. So I think it's the best time. You've got energy, you've got your finger on the pulse, you're quick, you're agile. As you get older, you get, you know, slower.
100%, Ricky. And look, at the end of the day, I think people need to kind of reassess what old actually means, right? You can start becoming an entrepreneur when you're 20 years old and literally fuck about for 15 years with failed projects, come out of it at 35 and still be very young. Like, 35 is not old.
No.
You know, there are people that I know that have fallen on hard times and they're in their early 50s. They've started new companies and they are absolutely killing it now. You know, like, people need to reassess what they think. And I find it so depressing when I see someone who's 25 and they feel as though that the weight of the world is on their shoulders. And you're just like, my friend, you know, that this is not how life works. You know, you are fine. You are young. You have time. Everything's okay.
And enjoy, it's fun, isn't it? Like, build a brand. Like, do it. You know what I mean? Like, what's the worst that can happen? It doesn't work. And you do something else, you know? Like, enjoy it.